Kathy Converse. I serve as the treasurer, and I'm also on the finance and program committees here at Prairie. Welcome to this morning, this day, and this opportunity to be together. Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society is a place where we come to learn more about being human. We're not here because we figured out life's questions or because we think we've got it right. We come here to learn more about being in a relationship together, how to listen, how to forgive, how to be vulnerable, how to create trust and compassion in one another, and how to live in a socially just world. We do that well here, though not perfectly. In this society, we strive not for perfection, but for authenticity and connection. Thank you for joining us. We welcome people from all races, ethnicities, sexual orientation, family structure, and religious backgrounds. We have no creed to which members must agree. We rely only on our ethical principles to guide. Whether it's your first time with us or your 100th time with us, we hope you'll find questions that stretch you, people to befriend you, and liberal religious values that challenge you to join us again. I'd like to welcome any guests we have today, and we will have a time. Thank you for taking the chance and the time to walk through our doors and join us. We'll give you time later in the service to tell us how you arrived here if you so choose, and we look forward to meeting you. Today's service is a continuation of a series of the study of the seven principles that Unitarian Universalism affirms and promotes. Today we are presenting Principle 7, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. And we'll mention again later that the offertory sharing today goes to the Road Home. And the Road Home provides temporary shelter and meals for homeless families and children while helping these families find long-term housing. And that is a group that we volunteer with on a regular basis. There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny. Franklin D. Roosevelt, 1936. So today I mentioned that rendezvous with destiny, but we're talking about the seventh principle. I don't think we could have anyone more qualified to talk to us about this. I'm going to take a moment because the wonderful thing about being lay-led society is we get to know more about people that we see every week, things we might not know. Peter Anderson here has a bachelor's degree in labor economics from Cornell University and a master's in land resource economics from an industrial organization in the solid waste industry from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Peter is the president of Recycle Worlds Consulting, executive director of the Center for Competitive Waste Industry, and project director for the Multi-State Plastic Redesign Project. He's been a senior lecturer at the University of Wisconsin Department of Applied Economics on Recycling Systems, chairperson of the National Recycling Coalition Policy Workgroup and its Landfill Subcommittee. He's been a landfill consultant for the Grassroots Recycling Network. Peter's been a keynote panel speaker at EPA's National Bioreactor Conference, a member of its peer review committee on landfill responsibility for greenhouse gases and climate change. Peter is widely published. He's also prepared major independent evaluations of landfill financial assurance for the California Integrated Waste Management Board and another on landfill gases contribution to greenhouse gases for the EPA. Peter is also a frequent speaker at technical solid waste conferences. And most importantly, Peter is the person who started the Dane Dances here in Madison. So let's welcome people. Certainly he can remind us how we fit into the web of life.
Could we lower that blind?
It's hard.
I can see Kathy.
Yeah, it's hard.
That's okay.
Well, Phyllis, you may be imitating, but in Dave, so I'm going to imitate Madonna. Not very well.
Can you flip it too?
I'm a big one into physicality. Let us honor the spring, the buds that are emerging. Because the return of life to the Midwest with its temperatures in the winter is something that we all think. But the emergence of the buds, the reason I'm mentioning this, used to be, in terms of the vernal equinox, to be a month or 6 weeks later. And I looked around the room when we started at all the youngins, 4, 5, 6 years old, and when they reach the age of some of the august folks here with gray hair, the compression of our seasons is going to be such that spring, with the emergence of the buds, will occur so much sooner it will coincide with the equinox. We've thought about, we always think about what we see around us, not in the technical sense we read in the science books, but in what our senses tell us. And we've had the unfortunate fact for action that climate change has come in a way that it's been focused so far in the winter and not in the summer. So people like us in the temperate regions who may not always love to have the length of the winters that we have looked upon the climate change that we see with our senses, which has warmed the winter substantially over a degree Fahrenheit, but not very much in the summer, as something benign. And it affects the way we react to the challenges we have. Before I start, I want to just put some things down as markers so that I don't come across as preachy, even though I'm at this thing here. And that is, if you remember after the BP tragedy, it was in this very room, some people were really furious during the comment period about British Petroleum. People were saying, those god darn, blah, 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 blah. And I thought, well, that's true. But I got up and I always like being a contrarian. I said, well, that's fine and good to holler at BP, but who amongst us has gotten rid of their second car? And people said, well, I have a Prius. And I thought about it for a minute. I said, well, I have a Prius too. Before I got the Prius, I used to drive about 8,000 miles a year. And after I got the Prius, it's like 14,000 miles a year. Anyway, when Molly and I were going home in the car, I said, now I open my big mouth, what are we going to do about it? We've got to get rid of that second car so we can show our principles. Well, that was, we talked about, well, how are we going to get Jed to see his girlfriend, and how are we going to do this, how are we going to do that? You can't imagine a list of excuses we drummed up. And we're still ruminating through those excuses today, 6 years later. And I'm someone who understands climate change in an intimate way, and I'm saying this to emphasize that we're all culpable of being Homo sapiens. And as Homo sapiens, we're wired in a very poor way for the challenge that we face. Is this falling again? And that we see challenges that are immediate when the lion is jumping into the village, but we don't see challenges when they're slowly coming down the road. And it's just the way we're wired. If it was an attack on Pearl Harbor, we would react, but we're just not reacting. And it's nice to say it's the Koch brothers or it's Exxon, but we all have these limitations unless we confront the fact that we can't just point fingers. We have to get something going that reflects our own infirmities in ourselves as well. We're not going to make progress. The other thing I want to mention is, well, it's as funny as you, Rachel, a couple of years ago, I don't remember how many, but you made a side comment, and I've just not been able to put it aside. And that was, you were wondering why it is that the evangelical churches have so many more people going to the third world and helping in the poor villages than we do who claim this high moral frame. And it's led me on a path that I become more and more convinced. I know I may appear irreligious, but I'm only irreligious as to organized religion. I have nothing against spirituality when we evolve it from ourselves and our community. And I'm becoming more and more of the view that we have to ourselves be willing to leave our comfort zones. And it's kind of like the thing about, you see, with religious history of self-flagellation. We have to, if we're not going to be willing to leave our comfort zones, we're never going to rise to that moral frame, that moral tier that we all aim for. And the other thing I want to mention is I don't speak here with a defined worldview to simply hand down from the mount. I remember when I taught a class at the university after I left the activist world in Wisconsin's environmental decade on how to be an activist. And the first year I taught the course at the university, I taught kids how to lobby and how to litigate and all those kind of normal mechanical things that go into becoming an activist. And the second year I said, I don't want to do the same thing again. That would be boring. And I saw an article in Time magazine that year about 20-somethings, where it said it had a 20-something quoted. I do apologize for my voice. I'm very sick, but I couldn't let the show them go on. And a 20-something kid said, my parents screwed the world up for my generation. And it occurred to me, when he said my parents, he was talking about me and my generation. I said, who the heck? I've been working 90 hours a week for 20 bucks a week. I said, who the heck does he have a right to say things like that about? And then it occurred to me that my generation said the same thing about my parents' generation. Which led me to ask, how do you turn the world, how do you move mountains as opposed to just spade fills? And I wound up saying to the class, let's try and figure this out. And I gave them books about the historical Jesus and about Sigmund Freud's civilization and its discontents. And we went in pursuit of a journey together without knowing where the destination lay. And I think for the kids in that class, it was far more interesting and far more valuable to have a journey of mutual exploration. And that's what I want to do today. I wish now that Dave Johnson was still here to help me in that journey. But maybe Rick can help. I once went to an Oliver Sacks talk, and he took his coat off. He went like that. But I do think in terms of where we need to think about what really resonated with me in that religious context, if you remember, I think it was 3 years ago, there was that bitter cold that overwhelmed the normal shelters in Madison. We were asked to set up a ad hoc shelter overnight. And I think many of you, as I was, came in and got the pillows and the blankets and everything set up. And we felt very good about ourselves doing that. But what I'll never forget is Dorothy, I'm sorry she's not here, but Dorothy took one of those folks home with her. And it was a challenge, I'm not trying to sugarcoat it, but there's something fundamentally different in terms of our spirituality when we just help with an arm's length helping people who need help than when we bring them home and share our table with them. And it's like a welfare system. It's all, we vote to have a bill passed and an appropriation made, but we're not there with the people who need help. And I wonder whether, if we want to be spiritual, I think that's one of the things that has really resonated here with so many of you. We have to think about, to do that, to really achieve that, it's not just enough to have principles. We have to go beyond, the principles are our foundation, but we have to go far beyond that. And it starts with leaving that comfort zone. Of all the issues that are interconnected with that web of life and the seventh principle, other than the possible avoidance of nuclear annihilation, which for those of us of my age preoccupied society in the 50s with the bomb shelters, the issue of climate change and global warming is the elephant in the room, is the 800-pound gorilla. We of the public, though, we need to understand that we're being fed by the scientific and political community pablum. And we're being fed that because the powers that be and the very sincere-minded scientists believe that if we were told what was the actual facts of the situation, people would become so discouraged that nothing could be done. And that's been the policy that's been going on since the issues became paramount with the last major El Nino event in 1998, when temperatures spiked and attention really got directed to climate change. But you have to say to yourself, is that the approach that's working? If we had acted in a galvanized way in 1998, the things that need to have been done would have been feasible and would have not required revolutionary change. Those 20 years we've wasted with the Bush administration and Mr. Obama's first term in office when he was too worried about re-election to face him, and with the Republican Tea Party reaction to his final attempts to do so in his second term, those 20 years have been disastrous waste. And what we've produced by making people not get upset, by telling people it's off in the future, by suggesting that all we need to do to make the changes is live in LEED rated, those fancy efficiency rated McMansions, and drive a Nissan Volt, GM Volt. And that's all we need to do. And then we can otherwise live the same consumptive world we live in now. It's a very simple thing. And that's the story that people have been told, all of us are being told. And what is it produced? This is very much like the Orson Welles and the Third Man, the cuckoo clock. We produced the Paris Treaty. And the Paris Treaty is good in the sense that at least the world governments didn't end in discord and refused to talk to each other. But unfortunately, the word treaty and all the hosiannas that have been extended to it have suggested that there's progress. Well, there's only progress because we've redefined dumbness. And what we have is a statement of 192 countries' promises, all defined in different terms, apples and oranges. Most of the key ones, which were repudiated upon the leaders' return to their country. Prime Minister Modi, India is the, I'm not trying to be critical of India, we're the most gluttonous country there is. We emit 19 tons of carbon a year in America, and India, 1.5. But when he got back, there are 2,400 new coal plants being built right now or in active stages of planning, which would release 6 trillion tons of carbon dioxide a year when built. And Modi, and he had to remember, to survive as a prime minister, this is our business model for politics in a democratic or autocratic society, is you have to keep people bellies filled and happy. And he's promised to bring electricity to all those poor villages that don't have electricity. And he came back and landed and said, we're not going to change one iota of those plans for coal plants. But even if you ignore all that, even if you ignore the fact that there's no enforcement mechanism, if you just pretend that everything specified in that treaty were done, in terms of the goal that's been set to not exceed an increase in our temperatures of 2 degrees centigrade, and that's one of the other killer things about this discussion, none of us know what the heck centigrade is. I wish they would keep it in Fahrenheit if we're not going to convert, and that's 3.6 degrees. And the thought has been that if we keep our temperature increase over pre-industrial times to 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, the temperature will not run out of control, And we can, that's a cute. Well, the temperatures will not run out of control, and we can stabilize things on a viable basis. But the promises made in the Paris Treaty only would go half the way to that 2-degree limit, and in fact would produce an increase of 4 degrees centigrade or 7.6 degree increase Fahrenheit. And remember, just a couple degrees is what changed in terms of global temperatures on averages, is what distinguishes us from what was the Ice Age before. These small numbers are enormously significant. There's been analysis of what 4 degrees would mean, which has not been seen on Earth in 3 million years. It would be a sea level rise of 6 to 7 feet high, persistent drought over 40% of the surface, and half the species would go extinct. And point of fact, most of the real science analysis show that that 2-degree thing as a goal was only put forward in 1992 because it seemed far enough out it would be when I am no longer in office. But it had no scientific basis. In terms of the jargon of climate change, in terms of how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere, in pre-industrial times it was about 280 parts per million. It's now risen to 400 parts per million, 401 parts per million. And we have to go back to 350 parts per million to get to a stable future for our kids. Not in terms of their dying, but in terms of a world being capable of sustaining a civilization. So the idea that this sugarcoating is the way to get the public response to overcome our synapses and act on a long-term existential challenge clearly is not working. And if it's not working, maybe the response that is appropriate is to treat people as adults and talk to folks about exactly what is going on. And what's going on in terms of what's not generally recognized is that there's enormous inertia in weather and climate. And what that means for us is the weather increase we're seeing, and we're seeing spring come about a week or two earlier now, is from the increase in carbon dioxide about 20 or 30 years ago. So we're seeing what those levels produce 20 years ago. That's when the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere was 345 to 360 parts per million. You can imagine what's going to happen when the increase that we have already put into making the system occurs. Nevertheless, what's coming down the pipe with all the coal plants being built. And remember also, and I was very much, I hadn't been aware of this until this study that came out. I'm going to give up on this. Just turn that one off, I guess.
Yeah. You got the lecture.
Yeah. The study that came out just 2 days ago in Nature Climate magazine was pointing out that the increase in temperatures in the temperate regions of North America, which I mentioned earlier, have been focused on warming in the winter and very little in the summer. And that disparity in terms of the way climate breaks out is about to reverse. And so we're going to see is not the benign side of climate change in the cold climate, but the very worst side of it. That's what's coming down the pike. The second thing to understand is that most of the way we've looked at environmental and pollution issues in the past is if there's a problem, we don't get to it today, we'll put the scrubber on the smokestack next year. We'll clean it up when we get the process to work. There is no put off and it's all right solution to climate change. It's like take as a metaphor a bathtub with a stopper in it that only has a very, very small leak. So as that bathtub fills up, it's not draining out. And the carbon dioxide that we're putting out when we drove, and I drove, and Ollie and Jed drove here today, the smoke, the carbon dioxide is going to be in the atmosphere, from our tailpipes, is going to be in the atmosphere for probably something like 1,000 years. So if we don't act essentially immediately, there is no going back. The problems we're creating are irreversible. And in addition to that, and the best example of this next point is methane. We can set off chains of reactions, positive feedback loops that become irreversible and keep on feeding more warming gases into the atmosphere. And so in the shallow seas of the Arctic and in the permafrost is 3 times as much carbon as is in the atmosphere. It was laid down in time, geological times, epochs before. And it's been locked up right now in the permafrost and in the ice. But one of the ways that climate change has acted is it's been focused on some areas. It's not even around the globe. And one of the feedback loops is in the Arctic. As the ice melts, so some ice melts, you have more ocean exposed, and from a shiny surface, you have a dark surface, and you're absorbing more sunlight. And that creates a feedback loop. And so, while we may have been seeing a degree difference here in our latitudes, they've been seeing 5 degrees in the Arctic. And what that means is the permafrost is melting, and that methane is coming out. And the reason why that is so frightening is methane is a greenhouse gas on steroids. And in the short term, it has 86 times the warming impact of CO2 per molecule. And if we don't stop the warming, that is not going to be able to be stopped. It's going to be irreversible. And the last thing about the next to last, is there is a lot that can be done in terms of efficiency gains here, as long as we don't overcome them by buying bigger full-wall TVs when you get something more efficient, which is that darn tendency we have. But we have to remember, India is 1.52 tons of carbon released per capita, and we are 19. Europe is about 9. And the people in India, just like you're seeing today with the people in China, are not willing to live as peasants any longer. And if we say to China, we want a global warming treaty in which we're going to commit ourselves to buy these LED rated McMansions, and we're going to switch from our cars to these Volts, and you stay where you are as peasants, do you think they're going to sign on to that treaty? No. And without a global treaty, there's no way to address climate change. The only way to globally address climate change is to recognize that they have a right to come up to the standards of living we have. And what that means in terms of the obligations on us, if we were in the next 20 years to cut our emissions of carbon in half through efficiency gains in renewable energy, we might reduce, after population gains, our emissions by 3.3 billion metric tons of carbon per year. And that's if we ignore the fact that we oftentimes have this rebound effect. We get bigger full-wall TVs and holographic screens. But if you take the 2.7 billion peasants in China and India and bring them up to our present lifestyle, even with that efficiency gain wrapped into it as an assumption, that would be 13 times greater increase than we would be saving. And what that means in simple English is that stuff you're being fed about all we got to do is get those lead-rated McMansions is not true. If we're going to accommodate the rest of the world, which is an essential ingredient to a global treaty, we have to live simpler lives. And our kids are going to have to be living in apartments in urban areas without cars and maybe just have car services for occasional use. And if, or maybe meet just once a week and all those kind of things. But the key thing I want to point out when I try and say to my colleagues who are all wedded to the idea of don't tell the truth, sugarcoat it, and I point out the difference between whether you're going to have a winning message by talking like George W. Bush after 9/11 when he said, go shopping, or when you had Churchill say, I'm not going to promise you anything except blood, sweat, and tears. And remember, for all the consumption that we do, because I don't think this is a very scary message if we just get and dig into this, for all of the consumption we've expended, you know, we must think about, we have doubled our consumption since 1970, and we weren't like we were dying, living in caves in 1970. Our happiness has gone down. Consumption does not mean happiness. And ultimately, the thing that brings happiness is not living on a glass tit and just sucking down that consumption. It's being doing something for something bigger than ourselves. And what is bigger than ourselves? Than our kids. What is bigger? It's a story that can be told. So what I wanted to wrap up and leave some time for people to react is coming back to that message that I keep on believing from what you provoke is that we have to get willingness to get out of our comfort zone and leap into life and be willing to get the to make the kind of extravagant efforts to get the systemic change that's essential if our kids are going to have a livable world. And so just to give an example of what I mean, so it's not just rhetoric, is maybe, remember there was Walden 1, and then B.F. Skinner had Walden 2, which was that little horror story. Maybe we need to have Walden 3, where people go into communities and show that you can live a simpler life, doing it for your kids, and be perfectly happy. And maybe DiCaprio, instead of having his all his talk and then having this these huge luxury escapes in Costa Rica, maybe he can come and visit too. But that'd be one kind of way of saying, I'm going to leave my comfort zone to provide a role model for what the world can do. I'm a member of 350.org, and what we're doing there is opposing the physicality of the climate assaults from the pipelines to take the physicality and raise it up. We're putting our bodies on the line by being arrested. But whatever it is that you feel you want to do, I think we can start with our principles, but ultimately we have to leave our comfort zones if we're going to be religious, moral, spiritual people, and nothing like climate change has ever propelled us to do so before. We're stable here, but the Earth is rotating now around this axis at 1,070 miles an hour. The Earth orbits the Sun at 66, and I better be right, or John's going to correct me on it, at 66,600 miles per hour. The solar system hurtles through the Milky Way at 560,000 miles an hour. And our galaxy, relative to the galaxies near us, hurtles through space at 671,000 miles an hour. Now I know, and I went to school when Carl Sagan was at Cornell, there's a lot of talk about life being prolific around the universe. I don't know if it is. When you think about how cold and austere space is, it seems to me it's a very rare and special thing. And this little planet, whatever its damn name is unique. And we have to value it. And to value it, we have to get out of our chairs and figure out something to do. And I know people here are going to excite all of us and do so. Thank you so much.
It's a trillion.
Well, I was curious. So if we reduce our emissions down to 1970s level, don't we still have a problem with population?
Yes. But I think if you compare the effect of population growth with consumption, consumption dwarfs. So I'm not saying population isn't an issue. Mm-hmm. I'm saying it's the issue that's subsidiary to how much we consume. And the problem I feel is that we have defined our success and our happiness on the basis of how much we consume. And the other problem, of course, is if you just come in gangbusters, this is a population issue, that's a buzzword that gets that divides the global dialogue. Because you're saying, my problem area is not on the table for discussion, it's just your problem area. I'm saying the biggest one is consumption and also population. And the point is to do this, to make a response that would both be adequate for our country, to climate, in terms of decarbonizing our economy, but also for the rest of the world, the kind of ways that would be is living in apartments, in urban areas, using mass transit for most of your trips, cars for occasional, using much less meat. Those would be much less meat. Meat is an enormous factor. It's as big as transportation. Well, I mean, to be fair, and there's some people come occasionally are on this issue. I agree with the nuclear proponents that the arguments used pre-climate change are not adequate to dismiss nuclear power. It needs to have a second look. But when I gave it a second look, it doesn't, the issues are bigger than the U.S. because unless you can't transport electricity across the ocean. You have to build a plant at the population center. So you're talking about massive numbers of power plants in India, Cambodia, Nigeria. And if you follow it all, the way corruption is rampant, think of the Bhopal tragedy, and how sensitive nuclear power is, I can't see it, and the nuclear proliferation. Once you recognize that being pro-nuclear means it's global into the third world, I can't say you can make a case for it. But I want to recognize something. The nuclear power people properly point out that solar and wind are intermittent. We can overcome, when you go and dig under the hood, we can overcome the intermittency from day and night because it is affordable when you pay all those things work to have storage for nighttime. But when you talk about a week of prolonged cloudy weather and doldrums, you're not going to be able to, it'd be like, you're not in the Sahara going to have a city where it has 100 plow trucks. To build storage is 100 times more expensive than the solar system, solar equipment. So to be fair to the nuclear people who want to try to provide stability, if you go renewables, you decarbonize without nuclear, and of course without coal and gas, you're going to have times when you're going to have no substantial power. And I think to myself, I was trying to get real by relating to something around me. We live in Crestwood, and we're the last plowed because it's dead ends. And so every other year we have a couple of times, once or twice a year, where 3 days we're locked in. You live with it. But you're going to have to, the biggest problem here is not And Einstein, his brilliance was when he recognized the speed of light was constant, no matter what your frame of reference, was to say, and no one could figure out what to do about it, he said, well, maybe time's not constant. Well, right now we operate in a world where electricity is always on. It doesn't have to be always on. You can live with it. It won't be a high energy economy, but is that more important than having your world for your kids? Well, I don't want to get too far afield, but the processes used to use it up so it's not so dangerous are very risky because they bring in the issue of nuclear proliferation. And so you're talking about geological disposal. Well, what I'm saying is that process in terms of plutonium is very dangerous in terms of proliferation, but let's talk about that more later so I can get other people to talk about this issue. Let me suggest this. Nuclear power is not real. It's just a wedge issue. It's just a pundit issue. It's so expensive, and it's not going to be able to be deployed in the third world where it has to be to make any sense. So it's just not, I mean, it's not a, I would suggest we spend our limited time, my feeling, that's my personal feeling, Doug, not in that interchange, but it's just not giving it the credence that it deserves, that kind of attention, because it's never going to rise to that level where it's going to be able to, they call these wedges. There's 9 wedges they're going to do to decarbonize conveniently without changing our standard of living. And because it's so expensive, even with the subsidies, and because it takes so long to complete, and it's not going to be, it's just not, it's
the precedent.
I don't disagree with you about the issue. I just don't think it's going to loom as a real long-term threat to getting things done unless we let it consume our
energy.
I respect you, Doug. I'm just saying, the way I look at it from my perspective, I think we need to focus every ounce of energy we can into changing people's heads about what we define as success and what we aim to pursue. And, you know, they say in advertising, they got to say it 20 times. The risk factor, I'm not trying to say just you're wrong, I'm just saying the risk factor of that focus is you... Remember the PBS series about the civil rights movement? Keep your eyes on the prize.
So thank you.
Let us all start our discussions and actions on stretching outside our comfort zones and start making positive changes for our and the next generation's destiny. Thank you again to Peter. Enjoy coffee and visit.